So with that, we will launch into the afternoon technical sessions, and we kind of continue to progress from the building blocks so that we have gone through so far in terms of policy and tools, and really getting into more of the application. How do all these things really work out there in the real world? So our next speaker is going to be Anita Anderson from the Department of Health, and Anita is going to talk to us about non-community public water supply. So we have about 1,000 community public water supplies, 6,000 non-community public water supplies in the state. The non-community public water supplies really occupy a very interesting and unique space in the Safe Drinking Water Act. They really straddle the divide between public supplies and private supplies, and I like to say that each of those 6,000 or so non-community supplies in the state is a snowflake. They're unique, hydrogeologically unique, and unique in terms of construction, unique in terms of the challenges, and it's a fascinating space in the Safe Drinking Water Act. So to tell us a little bit more about that, Anita Anderson.
Well, thanks, Sandeep, and thanks, everyone. I appreciate this time to talk to you a little bit today about non-community public water systems and what life is like here on the public-private boundary. Like I say, my name's Anita Anderson. I'm currently the engineering supervisor of our small group of non-community engineers. I recently did a stint as the unit supervisor, but I want to introduce our new unit supervisor, Miles Schacher. If you haven't had time to meet him, he'll be around. You can talk to him at the break. But so just a really quick outline. We've already been briefed a little bit on what is a non-community water system, and then I'll go into our MDH approach for working with them, and then talk a little bit about some outcomes, challenges, and opportunities. So I think there's going to be a quiz on this. We're drilling into what the definition of a public water system is. Other people talked about the differences or kind of the broad level. The system needs to serve an average of 25 or more people for at least 60 days of the year or have 15 service connections. We then further break it down into the community systems that serve people in their homes and the non-community systems that serve people where they work, gather, or play. So maybe I'll just go into a little bit of the nuance. So it seems straightforward enough to say, is there 15 service connections? How many people does this system serve? But when you get into something, let's just say a condo association where you have a mix of residents and then people that are snowbirds and they're not there year-round, how do we figure out the population there? Or something like an event center that's really popular now. What if they only have five events, but they've got hundreds of people at those events? Seems like we should be looking at their drinking water, but it's a little bit borderline whether they meet this definition. So there are some guidances from EPA on how things fit in here, and then we've developed some other internal policies, but can be a little tricky sometimes. But if we kind of look at our range of non-community systems, Sandeep kind of said they're snowflakes, all individual. But we do have, like I say, a range of complexity. So if we look at the bottom right-hand picture here, that's a hand pump. So we have maybe a park that just has that hand pump. That's their entire source of water, but they have a lot of people coming through drinking that water. That's a non-community system. In the upper right there, we also have really large food manufacturing facilities or dairy farms. So they can be, again, complex and serving a lot of people, a lot of employees, as well as that water being used in their production. And then maybe on the left side are maybe our more typical or average systems. Up on the top is a campground or a small resort with a small distribution system. And then on the bottom left is something like a school where, again, students are drinking that water routinely, or it could be a factory or something with employees. So we have these in every county of the state. Again, could be, again, as big as Camp Ripley, as small as that hand pump, just a wide variety of interesting systems. Some people have already presented the numbers here. So on the left, again, is our community water systems that are either those cities or towns or things like mobile home parks or other residential housing. And we have close to 1,000 systems, community systems. Then the next in the box there is our non-community systems, almost 6,000 of those. About 500 of those are in the non-transient category, schools, offices, and factories. and then over 5,000 in the campgrounds, restaurant and resorts, or the transient systems. And then going to the private wells, we think that 450,000 is probably a low estimate of the number of private wells. So we have a lot to deal with that non-community, but again, that work with the private wells is super important and just challenging based on the numbers. A couple more kind of boundary layers here. We think, again, could easily divide between non-transient and transient, but even at those transient systems, maybe you don't have the 25 employees that make it qualify for the non-transient, but you might have 5 to 10 employees that are drinking that water on a routine basis. So how do we protect those people from maybe the more chronic contaminants? There's also even another gray area between non-community and private, where we have something like a bed and breakfast or a really small manufactured home park that only has a few homes. And those don't meet the public definition, but they may not, you know, visibly from the outside look like a private well either. So we want to make sure those systems don't get lost in the shuffle either. So a little thing, few comments about kind of what it looks like here on the public-private boundary. Non-community wells are actually often privately owned. You know, it's a privately owned resort, but they serve the public. And what does that mean? Again, someone looking from the outside might consider it a private well, might not know it needs to follow the rules of a public water system. And also, sometimes they aren't eligible for some of that public funding we talked about. Funding public water systems is not always available to all non-community systems when it's coming like from the federal money and stuff. Now, non-transient systems are really subject to almost all the same regulations as the community systems. So a lot of effort goes into that and a lot of monitoring. But they are a little less visible. They can fly under the radar a little bit more. You don't hear that much about water quality issues at these systems. Maybe schools and things get some attention, but I commend the community group for, you know, having to deal with that public pressure all the time. Non-transient systems need a certified operator. Transient systems are not typically required to have a certified operator. So again, it's training those well owners, homeowners, church members to be taking care of their water system. As far as plan review goes, plan review is not required for non-community wells, as it is for community wells, but they do get inspected by our well management staff during construction, so we try to have some oversight onto that. Most non-community systems serve less than 1,000 individuals, and most don't have disinfection treatment. So 99% of non-community systems do not provide disinfection. As again, compared to the community side, where 90% of the community population is served by a disinfected system, even though kind of similarly small community systems often do not provide ongoing disinfection treatment. And some non-community systems have more than one source. And again, the majority of our systems are groundwater-based. We do have about 60 or so non-community surface water systems up in the northeast part of the state, so it's kind of a neat group we have up there. Just kind of some basic statistics on non-community public water supply wells. I mentioned, you know, we have close to 6,000 systems, but we have 8,000 wells, which kind of plays into the fact that some systems have more than one source. Our median depth for non-community or non-transient systems is about 180 feet, as opposed to 117 feet for the transient systems, most likely reflecting just the capacity needs at the transients versus the non-transients, and potentially that there's maybe more play between that public-private line on the transient side as well, so they tend to be smaller sometimes, which is also reflected in the casing diameter, which is 6 inches for the non-transients and 4 inches for the transients. Again, comparing that to the community side, median community well is 275 feet deep and casing diameter of 12 inches, so just larger wells on the community side. And I won't go too in-depth about the different aquifer types, but we do see a wide range of aquifer types and different types of wells, both materials of construction, capacity, again, those sorts of things. But maybe the most remarkable thing on this slide is just the fact that over 3,000 of our non-community wells don't have aquifer information, so we don't have well records for a lot of these non-community wells, and that's maybe because they came, you know, they're pre-code wells or wells that kind of transitioned to being public water systems from being something that wasn't regulated before the Safe Drinking Water Act and so on. So it can make it challenging sometimes, again, if we're trying to diagnose issues or do any sort of statistical work or modeling or predictions, we just don't always have as much data on the non-community side. Kind of one challenge in relation to living on this boundary is private to public well conversions. So if you're familiar with the well code, some revisions in 2008, both required full-length grouting for public water supply wells, whereas that hadn't been required before. And then if a well, like I say, a lot of times, let's say a person wants to start up a daycare in their home, then suddenly their private well is going to become a public well. Or we talked about the event centers. You have a nice barn and you have your old farm well and you want to now make that a wedding event center, and now you're going to want to make that well again into a public well. But for it to be converted, it either needs to have been a public water supply before those well code changes went into effect, or it needs to meet the standards. So where we run into the issue is that if it's not full length grouted, it can't become a public well, and sometimes that doesn't make people happy, but it's again trying to step forward, trying to improve construction and improve those conditions on wells, but it can be a difficult transition to work through, but we have some good tools for that. So I'll just go briefly. You may have heard about some of these things in the spring conference, just overall what MDH drinking water protection and what we do. I don't necessarily have to read everything there. You can read it, but again, variety of things, and maybe what you don't see there, we're educating, we're training, we're assisting, we're trying to fund things. We really try to run a compliance program, a technical assistance program as much as we can versus just a straight compliance and enforcement. Thanks to our predecessors who I think had a lot of foresight to make that approach. I think it's been very successful in the state. So we're trying to provide, again, the safe drinking water through strategic safeguards from source to tap. I probably missed something there in our vision statement, but we do try to look at the entirety of the public water system. We're broken up into now 7 units. We've heard about some of the funding, recent funding for infrastructure money, changes to the lead and copper rule, so we now have our infrastructure unit that's focused on getting those loans out to systems and also replacing lead service lines. Our communication unit is also quite new. We've had communicators in our section for a long time, but we're just, again, seeing the increasing importance of that communication on various fronts over time. So we now have a unit devoted to that in addition to our other ones that you've pretty much heard from most of them either today or in the spring. We have over 140 staff in the section with a variety of roles and classifications for our staff. And of course, we work with a lot of partners as well, which has been also covered by other speakers. I did just want to call out a few ways we partner, particularly with other state agencies. So we have, you know, Department of Agriculture with its focus on kind of pesticides and other contaminants related to agriculture. Then we have MDH working with the public water systems in addition to the well code and well management. And then we have pollution control, which is primarily concerned with, you know, contaminant issues and discharges to the environment. And then on the quantity side, we have Department of Natural Resources. So in particular, how the non-community unit tries to partner with other states, we like to get non-community wells included in studies, both for our own information, and then we just kind of, I talked about the difference in well constructions. Oftentimes, non-community wells will probably help fill the gap or kind of fill in and make sure we're representing all wells in the states, and we have good relationships in general with our system, so we can get them to participate in studies. We can also get them to collaborate on contaminant response, so we work well with MPCA on responding to contaminants that affect both non-community and private wells. We collaborate on treatment when that's needed based on a contaminant we're finding. Again, plan review is required for all non-community systems for any treatment changes or infrastructure changes. The only exception really is the drilling of the well, which has other safeguards. And we can also help monitor these things. Again, we're out there frequently, so we can support monitoring efforts. And then we like to work with DNR to plan for both drought and flood conditions. So we really hope we gain a lot and hopefully give something to these partnerships. So looking specifically at our unit, we have a total of 39 staff in the non-community unit. Primarily these are our field sanitarians, and we've divided up those over almost 6,000 systems between those field sanitarians, so about 250 each they're responsible for. Right now we have a groundwater engineer and a surface water engineer in addition to myself. We have 6 compliance staff, a planner, an educator, and then our 6 regional supervisors. We do delegate some oversight of transient non-community systems to local public health or local agencies in 21 counties currently. And as Sandy mentioned, again, we have our territories that vary in geology and type of PWS and size, so each territory kind of has its own issue. Up in the Northeast, you might be running more into the bacteria issues with our bedrock geology up there. Central part of the state, again, we see some arsenic contamination, some nitrate. And I should note, too, the numbers vary a lot. So in the Southwest, there's a lot of the rural water systems coming in there. And so we have a smaller number of non-community systems in the Southeast. So you can see that person's territory is a lot of counties, but there's just not as many systems there versus, if you can see, Crow Wing County is the one county that's 2 different colors for one county. So there's just so many wells there in the sand and the kind of vacation area that it takes 2 people to cover that one county. So really the challenges we see and what your life is like is quite different depending on where you're located in the state. I just wanted to touch on a little bit what authorities we're working under. So Randy did a great job of covering the Safe Drinking Water Act and noting that MDH is responsible for implementing the Safe Drinking Water Act in Minnesota. These rules, of course, apply to public water systems. And again, we focus on that technical and compliance assistance. In addition to the federal regulations, we have our own state regulations for public water supplies. And probably the most important thing about our rules is that we adopt the Safe Drinking Water Act by reference, which is kind of nice because every time the Safe Drinking Water Act changes, we don't have to redo our rules necessarily. We're just adopting those changes pretty much automatically. Other things that are contained in our rules include some specifications on treatment, although we keep that pretty broad and use existing codes and standards like the 10 state standards and plumbing code to review treatment plans. We do have a small section on water haulers, so occasionally people will need to again, haul water as a public source when the groundwater just isn't going to give you anything there. We have the wellhead protection rules, and also the revolving loan fund is covered in the rules. Some other authorities that apply both to public and private systems are the well code, the plumbing code, and the food code. So again, where it can get interesting is some of those systems that serve the public but do not meet the definition of a public water supply, it's kind of a little bit hard to fit them into the rules sometimes and understand what exactly a Safe Drinking Water Act at those systems. So just diving in a little bit to our non-community drinking water approach, we really try to be proactive, find things before there's a problem, get out there, you know, we think monitoring is an important thing for water quality, but really the inspections are super important to see just generally how the system's running, what the condition is of all the system components, and try to find problems and fix them before we see a water quality issue. But we do also sample and then respond to those results, again, focusing on problem solving and relationships and trying to review plans so that things get installed properly on the front end. Also spend a lot of time on the education and public information, whether that's required public notice based on finding contaminant or according to the rules. We also have some consumer notice requirements where we're actually being going a little above and beyond what's in the Safe Drinking Water Act, but we feel it's important to advise consumers on what the quality is of their drinking water. We also have a newsletter specific to non-community systems, other communications, in addition to just general public education. So again, our primary inspection tool is our sanitary surveys. These are required by the Safe Drinking Water Act to be done. Actually, Safe Drinking Water Act is 5 years. We do these every 3 years in Minnesota. And again, to be proactive and also to, yeah, it just seems like 5 years is a long time, and doing that a little more often gives us some more leeway with some other elements. And those surveys include looking at the entire water system, again, from operator compliance to the source, to the distribution, to pumps, and as well as management and operation. I think Steve mentioned the inner wellhead management zone work. So we partner with our source water protection unit to do those contaminant inventories. We write wellhead protection measures to address those contaminants or manage them. So we've added that as part of our sanitary surveys. And then we're out there at these systems every year also doing an annual site visit. So any year that they're not getting a sanitary survey, they are getting an annual site visit where we both do our annual sampling and do kind of a mini sanitary survey to make sure nothing's happening in between those surveys. Of course, water testing is an important part of managing water quality. The transient systems, since that population is not drinking the water on a routine basis, they're monitored only for acute contaminants. So these include coliform bacteria, nitrate, and nitrite. Whereas the non-transient systems, of course, people are drinking the water more frequently, and so they are monitored for both the acute and chronic contaminants. So those chronic ones, common ones we've heard about today, arsenic, metals, less commonly found VOCs, pesticides. Again, Randy mentioned there's over now 90 contaminants that are regulated. We also sometimes do investigative monitoring just to diagnose problems or do those research efforts. In Minnesota, again, we've taken on most of the monitoring ourselves rather than just having to spend a lot of our time asking people to send in water samples. We have our staff collect those. That also gets our staff out on site, but ensures we know that those samples are collected properly. There are a few that are collected by the water systems themselves, like lead and copper, because those are first draw samples, and it'd be hard for our staff to get out there based on that timing. Or if they are set on a more frequent monitoring, like monthly sampling for coliform, then we have the system collect those. And we will also do resampling if any issues are identified. I didn't want to forget our compliance group. So I mentioned we have now 6 compliance people in our group, and they're really the ones that know the rules the best and are responsible for scheduling our samples and for doing the review of the results when they come in, and then determining compliance status, and determining if we do need to enter into a compliance agreement with a system to keep them moving in the right direction, or on those rare occasions that enforcement is needed, we will go ahead and do that. We also do have a waiver program, not to get too nitty-gritty, but if there's a contaminant that isn't used in Minnesota, or if we have shown that the source is not vulnerable, we can avoid doing some sampling, be more efficient there. And we need to report to EPA all the work we're doing, because they are our oversight agency. I guess I talked a little bit about this, the inner wellhead work. So these are the kind of maps that we create at each system, just mapping all the contaminant sources within 200 feet of the wellhead. Again, developing the wellhead protection measures based on the types of contaminants we found. And I don't think the source water group didn't mention this too much, but they are in the process of revising their wellhead protection rules right now. And part of that's to make it more useful to small systems. So currently, non-community systems are required to have wellhead protection plans, but that kind of template that was laid out for the bigger systems, we've found just doesn't really fit non-community systems too well. So we're going to be moving to more of an action plan approach, something that's more doable, more accessible to the non-community systems. So we're really excited to be looking forward to that change. And I think with the source water protection grants were also mentioned. So under the Clean Water Fund, there's now a grant program, a matching grant program. So I mentioned some of these non-community systems that aren't eligible for some of the things that are available to publicly owned facilities can now get these grants to make improvements to their systems. So this chart just shows where these grants have gone over the last 10 years. So primarily it's to replacement wells, to the well ceiling. In some cases we need to do treatment because we can't fix that contamination. In some cases we can repair the well, or you can see these smaller categories of backflow prevention or trying to manage the contaminant sources themselves. But we're really, really excited to have that program. It makes it much easier, again, to be out there in the field working on compliance and have a tool to support them on the financial side. Got a short video that we developed for non-community systems.
A non-community water system is a place that provides drinking water to the public. A non-community system would have its own well and provide water to the distribution system, so it'd be one individual distribution system. So the responsibility is up to the system to provide safe drinking water to the public. But the Minnesota Department of Health does regulate by collecting water samples and inspecting the systems. There are approximately 6,000 non-community water systems throughout the state of Minnesota.
I'm Ed Aletto. I'm a sanitarian with the Non-Community Drinking Water Protection Unit out of the Rigi District Office. We help the owners and operators with their distribution, their wells, and their treatment, among other things, to make sure that the water is safe for public use. You know, their public water supply is probably not on their mind every day, but it's on ours. So when they're down there at the dock working on things, we'll show up to do their water testing, and a lot of times they'll come with us. Sometimes they're too busy and they can't, but that's where our job comes into play. We can look at their system for them, make determinations on what might or might not be safe, and try to correct them as soon as we can.
Well, hopefully that helps just give you kind of a picture of what it's really like out there. So thanks for your patience. It's the first time I've tried a video and a presentation. I don't know if I'll do it again, but hopefully it'll just work. Okay, so quickly just looking at some outcomes. I guess some of these are outputs, some of them are outcomes, but a lot of samples collected, over 15,000 at non-community systems. Again, 2,000 surveys, 4,000 annual site visits, but maybe the most important outcome is that we have over 99% compliance with Safe Drinking Water Act MCLs. Overall, systems are in good shape. We do still see some issues with what we call sanitary defects, whether that's a connection that we think is potential to cross-contaminate the public water supply, again, aging wells, some plumbing issues. Sometimes we see the maintenance issues, total coliform detections. Again, those can sometimes be hard to resolve. And a small number that have MCL violations that we need to resolve. Just to look at our two most common contaminants of arsenic and nitrate. Again, a little unfair to look at these maybe on the same scale because arsenic is only monitored at the non-transient systems. Nitrate is monitored at all systems. The arsenic rule went into effect at 2006. That's when we saw a little bump up in the arsenics, and that's kind of settled down to typically one or two systems a year that we're seeing exceeding the arsenic's standard. Nitrate, not completely sure, but seeing that downward trend there could either be because we now have the source water protection grants available where we can replace those wells that had nitrate contamination, or just, again, focusing on other source water protection efforts to reduce that. E. coli, we don't run into E. coli all that often. You can see there's kind of a seasonal pattern, find more of that in the summer generally, but tends to be highly variable. Some years are worse than others depending on precipitation and other things. I just wanted to mention manganese, as we heard about that earlier. We have started, again, it's not a regulated contaminant. On the non-community side, we've been starting our manganese monitoring with our schools and daycares where we have that most vulnerable population. And the upside of this is we found that softeners are very effective at reducing manganese. So if we're seeing elevated levels, we can have someone install a softener, or people that already have softeners installed are already taking care of that issue. So that's good news. Again, we heard a lot about PFAS sampling. We have not monitored yet statewide for PFAS at non-community systems, but we've been sampling East Metro for many years, both transient and non-transient, just because they were in that area where both private and public wells were being addressed. We've now moved into statewide sampling, currently focusing on areas near known sources of contamination. And again, then our next step will probably be all trying to get all schools and daycares before we start getting into being required to under the regulation. And we do send health advisory letters when we see exceedances there and work with people on action steps. So just to conclude, again, future challenges and opportunities. Kind of the challenge sometimes with these small systems is just that, water is not their main business function. They're trying to do all the other things we mentioned, run a church or run a business. So getting them to stay interested in water is always a challenge, but and just having that operator knowledge when there can be a lot of turnover. I mentioned the financial constraints, but we now have some of those grants available. We'll be hearing more about our pathogen project coming up next. So that's something we're still keeping an eye out on in addition to the PFAS, manganese, and also lead. So with that, I will see if there are any questions, and thank you again for your time.
Hi, nice talk. I was wondering if the data that you guys collect every year, is that publicly available on your webpage?
No, but we're working on that, but yeah. Yeah, summaries and some of that stuff is available, if you can make requests, but we're not yet at the point where we have it all on the website. All right, thanks.
Thank you, Anita, and then the whole issue of data. Yeah. So I just wanted to, since we've had this issue of data touched upon several times during the day, MDH's desire, I'm just putting my MDH hat on now. It's probably a violation of protocol. I should be firmly just having my MGW hat on throughout the day today. But just to address that issue, MDH, right up to the uppermost level, really, really believes in transparency. So there's a great push to get the data out. Just open book, public water supply data should be available to the public. But no surprise, we run into limitations with our IT department, centralized state IT. So trying to, you know, work with them to build a platform, which we have for our PFAS data. So all the MDH PFAS data is out there real time for anyone to see what the PFAS concentrations are, community public water systems. So we want to replicate that across the board. So we'll get there hopefully sooner than later. But great question there.